A Republican who served for 8 years as governor of a state in which Democrats outnumber Republicans by 500,000 and in which Hispanics make up almost a quarter of the population, yet who left office with an approval rating of more than 60%. Today on Uncommon Knowledge, the 43rd governor of Florida, Jeb Bush. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. The son of one president and the brother of another, John Ellis Jeb Bush, served as governor of Florida from 1999 to 2007. In a state that has no income tax to begin with, he cut taxes in each of his 8 years. And although registered Democrats outnumber registered Republicans in Florida by 500,000, Jeb Bush left office with an approval rating of 63%. Jeb Bush now divides his time between practicing business and speaking and writing about public policy. Earlier this year, Governor Bush and his co-author Clint Bolick published Immigration Wars, Forging an American Solution. Governor Bush, welcome.
Peter, it's good to be with you.
Segment one, what's wrong? Jeb Bush speaking earlier this year. This is from your CPAC speech. Quote, I travel a lot, and I've seen firsthand the explosive economic growth in places like China, Singapore, and Brazil. The streets bustle with energy. When I return home, the mood is different.
Yeah, I think we've lost our embrace of dynamism. I don't think we're as excited as a nation about the unforeseen, about the discovery around the corner. Even though, particularly sitting here, you know, in
Northern California,
if you don't see the future as incredibly bright, I think you're missing what's happening. This is a time. This is the greatest time to be alive, and yet, I think our country has lost its confidence about the future, and therefore it's easier, and more of us tend to default towards economic security in the form of larger government, and so the countries that have embraced this dynamic approach, the American approach, are the ones that now are full of optimism, really, you know, thinking that there's an incredibly bright future, and we're moving away from that and moving towards a philosophy that looks more like Europe's.
Europe. So, you know, there are those who would say the United States of America is in its third century. As the country ages, as the population ages, it's only natural for us to look more and more like Europe. We've got government spending now accounting for about 40% of GDP and growth at about 2%. Well, that's what France and Germany have experienced for several decades now. Our relative decline in influence in the world, Britain went through that half a century ago. What's happening to the United States is what happens to big countries over time. So, Governor, just get used to it. This is the new normal. How do you answer that?
That's incredibly depressing. I mean, what a very pessimistic, and I hear this all the time.
Sure.
It's a very pessimistic approach. The idea that somehow we're in perpetual decline is not something that people that have some influence over the process should accept. We should be able to reorganize ourselves and to regain our footing and to look at our past and see what's been successful and apply it to the future.
All right. Now, while we're talking about what's wrong, there's one political party. We'll come in a moment to your policy prescriptions for the country. There's one political party, your political party, that broadly speaking agrees with you. And they believe, as you believe, that the mood of the country is out of sync with the underlying reality. And yet, it is that, well, here's what you yourself said about the Republican Party. I'm quoting you. Way too many people believe Republicans are anti-immigrant, anti-woman, anti-science, anti-gay, anti-worker, and the list goes on. Many voters are unwilling to choose Republican candidates because they feel unloved, unwanted, and unwelcome in the GOP. The Republican Party that agrees with your view of the United States, that elected Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, and now repels millions of Americans. How did that happen?
You know, I think we've become too reactionary. We have not been as positive, offering concrete proposals that are embedded or based on this principle that the future is incredibly bright. If we believed it, we would be advocating across the board principles and policies that would advance that notion. We've become, partially for good reason, the overreach of the President Obama, mm-hmm. has deeply disturbed a lot of people. And I think what people on the sidelines see is a Republican Party based in Washington reacting to this overreach rather than seeing what our, you know, positive proposals
what
are
Scott
for the
Walker's
future.
What Scott Walker's doing in Wisconsin.
So we have 30 governors. We right. have a majority of
Sam Brown back in Kansas.
Yeah. Brian Sandoval, Susana Martinez. Rick Scott is, you know, working hard in Florida. Rick Snyder. These are governors that
Impressive
are
people.
Being and doing and making a difference. But if you look at the political landscape, we've become pretty Washington-centric in our, you know, who's opining and what's going on, and that's not a pretty place right now.
Right. Segment two, growth. Jeb Bush writing in Newsmax, quote, "The conservative movement has to be a movement of growth. Our focus needs to be on how we can grow our economy. The only path to the reduction in debt requires growth in the private sector." I could have done a word count, and I'm sure I'd have come up with the use of the word grow or growth another dozen times in that one article. So how can we do it?
Well, we should have a patriotic energy policy based on American innovation and technology and North American resources. We could be energy secure within 5 years. We have a $300 billion balance of payment deficit just on oil imports alone. That could be wiped out if we created a strategy. I think an immigration policy that shifts towards an economic approach rather than family reunification is critical to that. Growing our population with aspiring people will increase our productivity and increase economic growth. Clearly, a transformed education system over the long haul would be part of this. Bringing regulation into the 21st century, a fiscal policy that's not about austerity necessarily, but does recognize that government spends way too much and that we should ask government to do a few things, but do them well. And if you do this, I think our economy could grow at 3.5-4% per year. And there is no tax increase that comes close to the revenue that could be generated for government at all levels if we were growing at 3.5 or 4%.
Taxes. Ronald Reagan takes office and the top personal income tax rate is 70%. He cuts that down to 33%. It's up to about 39% now, depending. In any event. Unless you live in California. Thanks a lot for that
one.
Keep an eye out for a quarter acre around Coral Gables, if you would, please. The point I'm trying to make is we've got a $1 trillion deficit every year, and tax rates are already relatively low. Is that one front on which there just isn't room to move?
We should be looking at creative ways to lessen lower tax rates on corporations, which are the highest in the world, and individuals in return for eliminating loopholes. I mean, the tax code is rife with all sorts of well-intended ideas that are in effect government spending. They're called tax expenditures for a reason. And the benefit of that would be it would generate more revenue, which, you know, that should be the purpose of tax policy, not expropriation of people's hard-earned efforts. And it would also shift power away from Washington and away from government into the hands of people to make decisions for themselves. The cost of compliance, the cost of all of the mind-numbing complexity of our tax code sucks the life out of economic activity in this country. And so I think a tax-neutral policy where you're lowering rates and lowering and eliminating deductions and credits and left-handed Albanian tax credits and right-handed Croatian, you know what? So, I mean, it's just a crazy hodgepodge would have those dual effect. It would generate revenue, more revenue for the government, but not in a way that you know, is a political way. Right now, tax policy is not based on narrowing the deficit. Tax policy is based on fairness.
Theoretical fairness, or class warfare, to put it another way around.
Yeah, I'm trying to be polite.
You are trying to be polite. All right. Monetary policy. Ben Bernanke, Rand Paul and his father have made a big point of attacking the Fed. So again, at the contrast with the Reagan years, Reagan comes in and my reading of what took place is that Reagan gives Paul Volcker the political cover, frankly, to tighten the money supply, wring inflation out of the system, and establish the basis for the 25 years of growth that followed. Well, now we have Ben Bernanke with the loosest monetary policy, certainly since the Second World War. No inflation because the economy is so sluggish. But are you generally favorably disposed toward what Ben Bernanke has done? What's your view on this?
Well, first of all,
because if you tighten it up and interest rates go up, the federal deficit becomes enormously larger very fast.
If you have, and that's the problem.
It's a bind. We're in another.
But it's man-made. It's made by this policy. The idea that quantitative easing is perpetual is really dangerous for two reasons. One, ultimately, the Fed can't be the only buyer of our debt. Right now, it's the majority of the debt is purchased by the Federal Reserve. Somehow that will be monetized in a way that either creates high inflation or a crisis of some kind. Secondly, it penalizes the savers. So I was really lucky, blessed in many ways, to be governor of the state of Florida. Floridians, many of them are retirees. There was an implied contract that still exists, at least rhetorically, which is you provide for your family, then you provide for yourself. You can retire and you can live in paradise in Florida, and you can live off of your income.
Right.
Well, today, that CD is in the single-digit basis points. Instead of getting any kind of interest return, the only beneficiary of this 0% interest rate policy is the federal government, the only major borrower in our entire system. All savers are penalized. And those that are seeking credit in the private sector that would be so necessary to jumpstart our economy and create a more robust growth scenario, they can't access credit. This policy, maybe with good intentions at the beginning to stave off what could have been a calamity
right.
of epic proportions, by sustaining it, I think, puts us in really perilous ground.
From a former governor of Florida, this point has particular moral authority, and I hadn't quite thought of it this way before. But there are millions of folks in Florida who played by the rules all their lives, and then Ben Bernanke came along and changed the rules.
Yeah. No, right. and it's the beneficiaries really are only in the financial area. So, we're creating an America where the access to the benefits of those kinds of things are narrowing to
Wall Street and Washington.
Wall Street investors in Washington, D.C., and that's a tragedy that has to change. And in addition to that, the other serious problem with our monetary policy is that it enables incredibly bad behavior in fiscal policy. So we have increased in the last 12 years our debt by 250%, say, and debt service today is lower than it was 12 years ago. And at the same time, this is going on as our deficits are in the trillion-dollar range, say, 60% of the debt comes due in 3 years. So we've narrowed our maturities in this lower interest rate environment rather than a normal person would say, oh my gosh, interest rates are so low, let's do 100-year bonds.
Right, right.
Let's take advantage of this. But our federal government, the Department of Treasury under Geithner and the new secretary, continues on this policy of basically using a credit card to pay for the structural deficits that are as long and as far as the eye can see.
Entitlements. Jeb Bush, again, I'm quoting you. We must also address entitlements. This is an area of great opportunity. Opportunity. The other party, meaning the Democrats, has shown no willingness to bring reforms to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Close quote. Governor, I put before you the experience of your brother, who, after being reelected president of the United States, devoted about 18 months of his second term and untold political capital to pushing for some reform of Social Security. And even his own party was so lukewarm in its support that not a single piece of legislation made its way to the floor in the House or the Senate. You are asking the impossible.
No, I'm not. Have you met someone who says that our entitlement system is sustainable?
No, I have not.
I've heard, President Obama has said it, but it's not, he can't believe it. He's a smart man. If something is not sustainable and by not acting we make it worse and make it harder to be able to deal with it, we have to put on our big boy pants and lead. And the problem with this political situation right now is if everybody's fearful about proposing, even if it's controversial, suggestions to solve problems because for fear of retribution, then we'll never get anything done. And I think there's a misopportunity here. I truly believe this is an opportunity. This is why I admire Paul Ryan so much. He really is the one person, and there are many others, but he's the guy that stands out in Washington as having the guts to lay out a detailed plan to deal with these problems that can be solved. These are not, unsolvable problems.
His home district is pretty evenly divided, Democratic and Republican. Yeah. So it must be the case that his own folks respond to somebody who has the guts, frankly, to try to take it on.
Plus, he persuades. He doesn't just say, I'm for this, and then leaves it at that. He recognizes that you have to use the language that's the proper language, but have enough specificity to be able to convince people that you're serious about it, and take and use the energy that you have, whatever energy you do have, to persuade people. And look at the last campaign. Governor Romney did not lose this election because seniors abandoned his candidacy. He won people over the age of 65 by double digits. Now, there could have been other reasons as well, but I think when he picked Paul Ryan, and during that two-week period right after the choice where they defended these reforms, they moved up in the polls. They didn't move down. I think
For 2 weeks, that campaign was on offense.
Yeah, and then for some reason they stopped talking about it and allowed the president and his campaign to define them, which is unfortunate. It was I think a President Romney today would be focused on solving problems, whereas this president is trying to win political arguments.
Segment 3, education. Jeb Bush, quote, "Each child in America deserves the best education on the planet, and why not? We already spend more per pupil than any other country in the world." I want to ask you about the education reforms you enacted in Florida in a moment, but first that statistic. If we spend more per student than any other nation, why do the statistics, I found statistics for eighth graders, why do they show that Americans rank 9th in math and 10th in science? For somebody who wants to know in a neat, brief summary, what's wrong with American public schools? What's the answer?
We have low standards. We have little accountability. We don't have a focus on rigor. And we get the result that we aspire to. Our country is not going to be a great country if we continue to dumb down the learning so that children get through this the maze of the K-12 experience. About 40% are probably college and or career ready after spending more than any
tens of thousands of dollars.
So I don't think it's the teachers. I don't think it's our students, are naturally dumber than the other students that are measured in these tests. I think it's a system that doesn't work. If you were a Martian, and you're not, but if you were, and you parachuted down to analyze the public education system in the United States, you would be confounded because you would say, this most dynamic country, this country that's the source of disproportionate amounts of technology and innovation, has decided its governance model is 13,000 plus government monopolies that are heavily unionized, focused on the adults.
The centerpiece, by the way, correct me if I make a mistake here, talking about what you did in Florida, but as I understand it, the centerpiece of your reforms in Florida was the A-plus
mm-hmm.
plan.
Right.
Very briefly, Florida students in grades 3 through 10 take the annual Florida Comprehensive Achievement Test. Based on the results, the public schools, the schools, not the kids, the schools receive grades from A to F. In schools that receive bad grades, students are given the opportunity to use vouchers to enable them to go to school elsewhere, including private schools and religious schools. How's it worked out?
It's worked out phenomenally well. The Supreme Court ruled that the portion of the vouchers, that voucher program, we have others, but that one was ruled unconstitutional. So now failing schools, parents can go to a higher achieving public school. But we have abundant school choice. We have transparent accountability. There's nothing more transparent than A, B, C, D, and F. And it's changed the system. So every kid in the school counts in this accountability system. And the net result is Florida's gone from being literally at the back in terms of any of the state-by-state assessments to above the national average in fourth and eighth grade reading and math. And the gains have been the greatest with the kids in poverty, limited English proficient kids, mm-hmm. Hispanic kids, African-American kids, learning disabled kids. In every one of those categories, Florida's in the top five in every one of those categories on the nation's report card, the NAEP test. So robust accountability was the first part of it, but then the strategies developed to assure that kids learned became kind of the hallmark of the plan.
I've lived in California for a couple of decades now, and I love the place.
It's beautiful.
During my couple of decades here, there have been two major ballot initiatives to provide vouchers to students in schools that are performing badly, mm-hmm. and the teachers' unions outspent the pro-voucher forces by a huge multiple, and both of those initiatives went down by about two or more than 2-1. Governor Wilson, back in the early 90s, proposed legislation similar to yours in which students at the very bottom performing schools, you'd think this wouldn't be threatening to anyone at all, students in the worst schools in California would be given some limited voucher assistance, and he couldn't get it through the California legislature. How did you do it? You know what I'm asking. What I'm right. asking is, how'd you get around the unions?
Well, two things happened. One, I said what I was going to do in the campaign. So I actually think it's important to not have a secret plan, but to have a real plan and a public plan that people can figure out on their own whether it's the right thing to do or not. So that 1998 campaign was about the A-plus plan for education. And I was the challenger, but my ideas on education were the dominant feature of that campaign. It allowed us to have a mandate, in effect, and the legislature sensed that as well. So we acted fast, and then we faithfully implemented in a way that allowed for it to be successful. Today, and vouchers were not, you know, they've always been controversial in Florida as well, but today a majority of African-American legislators support the school choice programs in Florida. The corporate tax scholarship program, where 50,000 low-income kids go to private schools, consistently gets a majority of the African-American support. So as the success became clearer, more people, the fears dropped and more people began to support it. So sticking with it, I think, is another important part of policymaking.
And Governor, this is a crude way to put the question, but I think you'll know what I'm trying to get at. Did you beat the unions or persuade them? You had to beat them.
No, we didn't. There was no persuading. In fact, the folklore is that the union mortgaged their building to support my opponent in my reelection campaign and then had to sell the building afterwards. So I'm not sure if that's completely accurate, but
it's the political reality. You wouldn't be surprised.
They're a very powerful group, and I always respected the union because I never confused what their mission was to what their true mission is, to represent the economic interests of school personnel, not just teachers. That's what they do, and so don't be surprised if they like monopolies where they collectively bargain, where there's no accountability, because that empowers them to deal directly with unaccountable school districts. I'm not surprised that they advocate that case. Al Shanker said it best in a moment of clarity when he said, when kids start paying union dues, I'll start representing them. We shouldn't be surprised that unions are principally there to support the interests of the adults in the system.
How do we take the lessons you've learned in Florida, mm-hmm. you've demonstrated in Florida, and apply them at the national level? Actually, that's the first question. Would you like to see more federal participation in education, or are you saying to the folks in the other 49 states, this should remain a state
Absolutely.
Responsibility, but look what we did in Florida?
That's exactly what our foundation does. It goes state by state to help policymakers, governors, state school officers, legislators to do exactly that, to take a version of the Florida experience or the Indiana experience or the Louisiana experience, share the lessons learned along the way, and help them devise strategies to bring about reform. And that should not be a federal issue. That should be a state-by-state issue. The other thing that I think, a place like California that has a stasis governor and a stasis legislature that isn't interested in much reform, I think, is to embrace the digital learning revolution, if you will. Hopefully it's a revolution, because the beneficiaries of that will be the content providers and the software developers and all of the bubbling up incredible talent that exists out here that could reshape education, could literally transform it rather than reform it. And so, you know, you would think that in that particular case, where you have a convergence of good economic development potential, plus the tried and true ability, the innovative spirit of California, could be a place where maybe California could lead the way. They're not yet, but a girl can dream.
Segment four, immigration. You are intent on solving the immigration problem. You make clear in this book, Immigration Wars, because you're eager. It's easy to get the feeling reading this book that you're almost desperate for the Republican Party to find some way to appeal to Hispanics. Hispanics, you argue, are socially conservative. They're religious. They're small business owners. In all kinds of ways, they are natural Republicans. But there is some dissent within the party, among observers. So what do you do? Journalist Heather McDonald, who notes the high high proportion of Hispanics who are on welfare, for example, quote, far from exercising a brake on the erosion of traditional values, the growing Hispanic population will provide the impetus for more government alternatives to personal responsibility. Republican Party ought to be wary of Hispanics, not rushing to embrace them, Governor.
The reason why we wrote this book was from a policy point of view, not a political point of view. But the political argument that we should not take advantage of the immigrant heritage for sustained economic growth that benefits everybody, to me, is ludicrous, number one. Number two, the idea that that if Heather's argument is correct, then I guess it's over, because the fastest growing demographic group in America, not just, we're not talking about 11 million undocumented people, but the people that are already here, the people that can begin to participate, become citizens, and then register to vote, and then vote, by far and away the largest and fastest growing new demographic are Latino voters. And so if the argument is all is lost, and I just completely disagree with that. I think that we... You know, politics is a dynamic business. You have to persuade. And all I know is from my own personal experience, the last time I ran, I got a majority of the Democratic Hispanic voters in the state of Florida to support about 60%. I got about 75 or 80%.
This is a very important piece of your record, so I want to ask about it and give you the chance to just lay it out explicitly. You did not merely win the Cuban vote. Cubans, for
no
historical reasons, tend to be conservative and Republican.
Right.
Losing your country to communists will do that to you.
Yeah.
You did not just win the Cuban vote.
No, that's right. And it was because governors can lead in this regard. Governors can appoint people that share their views in the judiciary. I appointed the first Latino Supreme Court justice. I had men and women of great diversity that were conservatives that worked in my administration. Every chance I had, I tried to embrace the idea that everybody ought to be able to serve. And in doing so, the newly emerging groups were the ones that were the most, that benefited the most. And in terms of policies, and in terms of advocacy, in terms of being and doing inside the communities, you can persuade people. And all is not lost. I mean, it's just, I find it amazing that people don't see how you can move the needle in a different direction. You can change the course that countries are on or politics is on. And to just surrender and say all is lost, I think, guarantees it. If you keep sending signals, we don't want you to be, of course we want your vote, but we don't want you to be on our team. You can't join our club. What do you think people are going to do? I mean,
we want your vote, but we wish you weren't here.
Yeah, it's like
not
that's
a
real
a message.
Winning message.
Right. Right.
So let me give you the best example. The canary in the coal mine aren't necessarily Latino voters. It'd be Asian American voters. They supported President Obama at a higher percentage than Latinos did. They have a higher income than the median in the country. They have more intact families. They're a higher percentage of college educated. They're more entrepreneurial. It would be, if that Martian came down again, that Martian would say, this must be a Republican group. 75-23. It's the reason why Mitt Romney lost Virginia. Asians, not Latinos. There's something going on here that goes beyond just kind of the easy analysis, from the outside.
Immigration wars. Briefly, you've written a book about it. This is a good, thick book.
Not that thick.
Easy. Well, I'm going to ask you to reduce an ox to a bouillon cube here.
Okay.
You and Clint Bowlick propose shifting the basis of immigration from family relationships to the nation's economic needs. Can you explain that? Tease that out for us just
a little bit. Sure, because it's surprising. Right now, about 13% of all immigrants that come legally come for economic purposes. H-1B visas, the very tiny guest worker programs we have, and 75% say come for petitioned by family members. So today in America, the law, which was changed in the 1960s, are
65, I think. It's an old law.
It's an old law, but it's now had this impact of what's called chain migration, where you can claim your elder parents, your adult brothers and sisters, your spouse, obviously, and your minor children. And the cascading effect of this now has crowded out all other forms of immigration. What we proposed was to narrow that down to spouse and minor children, to create a legal category that allowed for people to come regular order, if you will, and then to dramatically expand the economic visas, both on the high end as well as a guest worker program to deal with the significant shortages that exist that are retarding the economic growth that we need. It mirrors in many ways what has been proposed in the Senate and what's being discussed in the House.
That brings us to the legislation under discussion beginning this week. In fact, hearings were held today. The proposal by the so-called Gang of Eight in the Senate, of whom probably the most prominent member is your friend, Republican Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio. The legislation is complicated, but I've got to try to sum it up very briefly. Immigrants already in the country illegally would register with the government, pass a background check, pay a fine, pay any back taxes, and they would then become RPIs, or registered provisional immigrants. We're all going to hear a lot about RPIs, registered provisional immigrants. The bill would implement a three-part enforcement scheme, including an e-verify system, an entry and exit system to check on visas. 40% of immigrants in the country today illegally are here because they've overstayed their visas, and three, increased border security. And here's the important part, or the nub of it, certainly the political nub of it. Only when all three parts of that enforcement scheme are implemented, and only after remaining RPIs, registered provisional immigrants, for some 10 years, would RPIs be permitted to register for green cards, and then after another long waiting period, only then for citizenship. Do you like it?
I think it does two things. There's a penalty paid for coming illegally, number one. Number two, before these folks could apply for citizenship, which would be from year 13 to, say, 16, I mean, way out into the future.
Way out.
The long lines of people that have been patiently waiting to get into the country through legal means would be flushed out. So the principle that people who have applied and have been waiting patiently are being treated better than those that came for, you know, most of which, by the way, came for pretty powerful motivations, taking care of their families, making sure there was food on the table for their loved ones, pushed out of their country because of a lack of economic opportunity. Whatever the motives were, they did come illegally. And this, I think, is important for future border security. If we're gonna have a going forward system that's where the border is secure, where people don't come illegally, you have to have a system where legal immigration is easier with less cost and less friction than illegal immigration. So it achieves that important point by extending this out over 13 to 15 years.
During testimony today, Mark Krikorian of the Center for Immigration Studies, quote, registered provisional immigrant status brings with it work authorization, a legitimate Social Security account, driver's license, travel documents. Registered provisional immigrant status is the amnesty. That is to say, it transforms the illegal alien into a person lawfully admitted to the United States. Close quote.
It's not amnesty if the objective is to get a green card or to get citizenship. When you're paying $2,000 in fines, you can't violate, you can't create a, commit a felony or three misdemeanors. You have to learn English. You have to pay back taxes if you haven't paid them. you're paying your debts to society. I would look at it this way. Mm-hmm. So someone crosses the border in whatever means. They came legally and they stayed, and they've made a life here in this country. Most of them pay taxes. Most of them are
sales taxes and so forth.
And some are paying income taxes because they've falsified their identification and they're you know, they're working as though people think that they're here legally. You know, so they've broken the law. But is the law that they've broken does it look more like a, you know, driving 100 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour speed zone, or is it like a first degree felony? I'll let people make that judgment themselves. But I would say it's closer to a civil penalty than it is to a felony. And if people did commit crimes when they're here illegally, they should be deported. No one is suggesting that they not be deported. And how are we going to enforce these laws without having people come out from the shadows?
All right. Now, here's my reading on a deep aspect of the political opposition, even to Marco Rubio and what he's proposing. Mm-hmm. And it's this. It's not anti-immigrant. It's that Ronald Reagan in 1986 signed an amnesty, but that was only half the legislation. The other half of that legislation was new and quite, by the standards of the time, quite rigorous enforcement measures. Ronald Reagan signed that legislation in good faith, believing that we wouldn't need another amnesty, that the illegal problem would end. And from 1986 to the present day, the federal government has consistently and willfully breached trust, breached faith with the American people. It has failed catastrophically under presidents of both parties to enforce laws already on the books. It's a question, it's a fundamental question of trust.
And the rule of law.
Rule of law.
There's no question about that. The book, and I truly believe this, there is a tension between embracing our immigrant heritage and the benefits that accrue in a very competitive world, we need to take advantage of our strengths, and a respect for the rule of law. I think this bill threads that needle by creating pretty significant penalties for people and extending this process over a long period of time, and then having three triggers on the border security, plus what you mentioned in terms of E-Verify and dealing and creating a visa system that actually works, where people can't come to this country legally and just overstay their welcome and not know where they are.
Jeb Bush, writing with Clint Bullock in Immigration Wars, the Republican Party, quote, needs to put immigration behind us, close quote. I'm pushing back on you one last time.
Yep.
But Governor, this won't put the immigration wars behind the Republican Party. These RPIs, registered provisional immigrants, mm-hmm. 11 or 12 million of them have to wait at least 10 years. We know, don't we, that the Democrats are going to say over and over and over again during those 10 years, 10 years is too long. They'll introduce measures in Congress a couple of years, beginning a couple of years from now, saying let's shorten that time. They'll say you should be able to receive certain federal benefits while you're waiting. And when those 11 or 12 million folks finally get to the end of that, of course, the Democrats will try to shorten it, but wherever the end finally is, they will be more firmly members of the Democratic Party than Hispanics today. How do you answer that?
I completely disagree.
You
with
do?
That. I do. I do. I'd
How
say.
Come?
Well, first
Doesn't
of all,
that sound like the political dynamic? It's
no,
plausible. No,
not at all. I think it misreads who these people are. For starters, let's look at the past to see if there's any indication of what the future looks like. In the 86 or 87 law, the 3 million people that were allowed for an expedited path to citizenship, mm-hmm. less than half applied for citizenship. People came to this country to work. The idea that somehow everybody that comes here wants to embrace our heritage, embrace what it is to be an American, has just not been proven out. People want to work. They want to come out from the shadows. They want to be treated with dignity and respect, but they maybe actually love the country that they came from.
So we know, for example, 19th, early 20th century, half of Italian immigrants to this country made some money and went home.
Yeah.
Same sort of thing would happen with Mexicans and others.
Absolutely. If half the people didn't come in an expedited process, why does everybody assume that, I mean, look, we all love our country, and so we just naturally assume that everybody else does. But people come for different reasons. People come motivated to provide for their families, to take care of their children, to make sure that their life is better than the one that they had. And they break their backs doing it. They work hard. We should show a little bit more respect and have a little deeper appreciation for what their motives are. And I think that would help the debate quite a bit.
All right. Segment five, final segment, Governor.
And by the way, if we speak like that, maybe the ones that do stay, maybe they'll embrace conservative principles and believe in individual achievement because they're doing it each and every day. Right. They're acting on conservative principles. They may not even know that they're conservative.
Segment five, a couple of questions. Here's the first one. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, 1965, famous report entitled "The Negro Family, The Case for National Action." I'm quoting Moynihan. "The fundamental problem is that of family structure. The family in the urban ghettos is crumbling. A middle class group has managed to save itself, but for vast numbers of the unskilled and poorly educated, the fabric of conventional social relationships has all but disintegrated. So long as this situation persists, the cycle of poverty and disadvantage will continue to repeat itself." Moynihan wrote that in 65, when the illegitimacy rate among African Americans was 25%. Today, the illegitimacy rate among white Americans is 36%. Among Hispanics, it is over 50%. And among African Americans, it is over 70%. Governor, education, economic growth, what does any of it matter if kids are going to be raised in fragmented, difficult, chaotic social situations and the American family continues to disintegrate?
It is our great challenge. Last year, I read a book by Charles Murray called Coming Apart that has just altered my thinking about this, kind of accelerated my thinking about this. Now, he's a pessimist about the future because of this. He concludes there's really not much that we can do. And I hope and pray he's wrong. And I think it's imperative for us to figure out a new language that allows for people to advocate wholesome, loving family life as the most powerful political institution in American society. We've struggled with this. I know I struggle with it because the last thing you want to be called is judgmental or intolerant or
anti-this or anti-that, as so many already have labeled the Republican Party.
So the knee-jerk reaction against having this conversation, I think, creates a barrier for conservatives. But we need to figure out how to address this. And the challenge, of course, is that as conservatives, we don't believe that government's the answer. Government can fill potholes. It can't fill the hollowness of the heart. I mean, you cannot expect the government, a five-point plan through the federal government to deal with the disruption of wholesome, loving family life. And at the same time, you have to be respectful of the fact that there are a lot of single moms that struggle mightily and successfully in bringing their children into the world and do so successfully. So this is work in progress for me. But I know it's hugely important. And to ignore it, all the rest of the policy just doesn't work without dealing with this as well.
You're married to a woman who grew up in Mexico. You served as a governor of a state with a big Hispanic population. As you note, in immigration wars, today more than half the population of Miami, not Hispanic, but more than half the population of Miami born
outside
the United States. At some basic level, I get the feeling that the project of Jeb Bush is to say to Republicans, but in some way really to white America, to folks who were raised the way you were raised, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, look, I've seen the future of this country in Florida. Relax, folks. This is going to work out fine. Is there something to that?
There's a lot of truth to that because the immigrant experience of my hometown, which has shaped a lot of my thinking, there's no denying that, does lead me to believe that the world's not coming to an end. In fact, it could be a pretty cool place. So I think that's absolutely right. Now, one of the things that's missing, and the book talks about this as a key point in the debates in Washington about immigration, is the need to – immigration works when there's a set of shared values that we all embrace. And I'm not sure today in America – we would, if we created a gigantic town hall meeting with 320 million people that we could reach a consensus about what those shared values would be. 100 years ago, we probably could have. 50 years, perhaps. Not sure we could today. And we need to have that conversation, because without that, then immigration can create kind of a Tower of Babel effect, if you will, rather than the aspirational nature of immigration being positive. So one of the things that we propose, and I think is a key element of a successful America going forward, is a revitalized focus on civic education, a respect for our Constitution, an understanding of our history, and a conversation about what those shared values should be.
Last question. You have a grandchild.
Yeah.
You're a successful businessman. You've done your time and then some in public life. You're 60 years old in a few months. What keeps you at it?
You know, I love my country. I loved when I had a chance to serve, and I love trying to help people be big and bold in the development of policy. It's a great intersection for me, and so I am passionate about this stuff still. And I see you can either say we're in a heap of trouble, might as well just check out. A lot of people are doing that these days.
Which people are doing, yes.
It's kind of disturbing to me. Or you can say, we're in a heap of trouble, but what a missed opportunity to fix the things that need to be fixed to create the next American century. I would prefer to be fighting this fight rather than carping on the sidelines.
I lied. This is the last question. And you have to forgive me for this one, because this is just mandatory. I can't not ask it. 2016, are you going to run for president?
I'm not going to think about running for president until probably next year, and then I'll think about it. And I will think about it in the following way. Is it right for my family? Is it right for me? Do I have something to offer? And then the politics of it. And so I can make a decision, but I know when to make it, and it's not now.
All right. Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida and co-author of Immigration Wars, thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.